immigrants and refugees who have fled violence can have a hard time getting the mental health care they need in the U.S. But today we'll speak with one man in Indiana working to change that. Plus, politicians are out in public all the time. The days of just business casual or black tie are long gone. The complicated politics of what to wear later this hour. Speaking of politics, Illinois Democrats want more revenue for the state. Gambling's a big piece of the puzzle. We'll talk about that as lawmakers approach crunch time in the state house.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. On this Monday, May the 13th, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, how one Rwandan refugee who moved to the Midwest is helping others recover from trauma. But first, Illinois is short on money. We've known this for a long time, and it was true both before and after the state budget crisis that lasted more than 2 years. We've talked about the billions of dollars in unfunded pensions and unpaid bills, but there's also an upcoming budget. When Governor Pritzker gave his first budget address back in February, he said that Illinois faced a $3.2 billion budget deficit. So he laid out a couple of proposals meant to raise money. The one that's gotten the most headlines is a change in state income tax. But even if that happens, that wouldn't take effect for at least 2 years. So what about faster revenue? Maybe in all the discussion about income tax, you missed all the other proposals that are meant to help raise money over the next fiscal year. I'm talking about sports betting, legalizing cannabis, changes to video gambling, just to name a few. So that's what we're going to talk about now. If you have thoughts or questions about some of our state's efforts to raise revenue, whether it's taxes on cigarettes, gas, or gambling machines, you can text us at 217-394-5765. That's 217-394-5765. Mark Maxwell is the Capitol Bureau Chief for WCIA3, host of the show Capitol Connection. Joe Bustos is a state politics reporter for the Belleville News Democrat. They're both with us now. Mark, Joe, welcome back to the 21st and good morning.
Hi, Nyla. Good morning.
Good to hear you, Nyla.
Mark, let me start with you. So we're thinking we're at about 2.5 weeks from the official end of session. This is the first under Governor Pritzker and a democratically controlled supermajority in the General Assembly. But seems like we've got a lot to get done. Like every other year, these last 2 weeks are pretty busy, right, Mark?
I don't know how they plan to get it all done. There is a lot left on the agenda, and it's going to be there will be some fireworks before this is all said and done. You can bet on that.
So when we're talking about fireworks, Joe, I wonder how much this need for more revenue, this need for more money for the state, how much you think that thinking affects many of the proposals in the state house.
Well, the governor said there's a $3.2 billion budget gap that he's got to fill. If he doesn't get new revenue, he said during his budget address, it could be 4% worth of cuts. So you've got to fund there's a lot of programs that the governor wants to fund, and you need money to do that.
So let's start with ways to raise money, and let's start with sports betting. When we were at the State House back in February for the budget address, House Republican leader Jim Durkin told us that he saw sports betting as a market that Illinois needs to get in on. Mark, is that what most lawmakers think about this, even if it's not something they approve of personally?
I think you said most, so a simple majority. If that's the qualifier, then I think yes. The answer is that a lot of lawmakers do see an opportunity here, and 10 other states have followed the Supreme Court's lead on this and legalized sports gambling. So there is some momentum across the country. The question is really about how to do this, because Illinois has tried to look at things like this when you talk about horse racing and gambling in the past, and it's been a bit of a windfall years ago, and then now switching over to more video gaming. So we've got this sort of piecemeal gambling/gaming infrastructure already sort of across the state. Plus you throw in the lottery, and they're trying to appease so many different interest holders with casinos and other different groups that it's, you know, DraftKings and FanDuel, the newer online fantasy sites, that really the big hassle here is not finding enough lawmakers who generally agree, but rather in finding enough lawmakers who agree in how to appease all of these different interests in the same way. And so everyone's sort of in a tug of war over who gets to be in the front of the line, who gets the most revenue. And that's really what they're trying to avoid here, is everybody pulling at this thing so hard that it falls apart.
And when we say that, Mark, what are the big, do we see any broad outlines of an agreement right now about what sports, legal sports gambling would look like in Illinois?
That's coming into clearer focus even just in this last week. Representative Mike Zaleski from Chicago's Southwest Side is spearheading this effort. He started with five different proposals, and he said, let's see which of these catches fire or which of these draws interest. And three of those hands have folded, if you will. So three of those proposals, five rather, have been boiled down to two.
Couldn't resist he that had, one run, right?
I couldn't resist the pun, I'm sorry. Yeah, but he's got House Amendment 1 and House Amendment 2 to his big gambling bill. And what he told us this last week was that these two plans are not necessarily an either-or, but the proposals in them have aggravated the casinos and the pro sports leagues and some of the others to some degree. So what they're doing is they're bringing them slowly to the table, hoping to extract some sort of a negotiation. So, yes, there have been some developments, but these things are fragile negotiations, and they could turn sour in a moment's notice.
And, Joe, do we know how much money Governor Pritzker is hoping to come from legalized sports betting?
In his budget address, he talked about bringing in an initial $200 million just in licensing fees. I mean, that's whatever outlets are going to be running this stuff, they would pay a $10 million licensing fee to be able to run this. So that's about $200 million just in licensing fees. And once it's up and running, there's some estimates that it could generate like more than about $760 million in annual wagers.
Is that annual licensing fees, Joe, or is that just a one-time?
I think it would be something that would be for a few.
That's a one-time mark?
Yeah. It could be something that would be you have to pay every year.
Right. So
I think they come back and ding them for like $250,000 a year after that or something. But it's a much smaller fee moving forward.
Okay. So that's an important point. Okay. So that's one piece of the puzzle, perhaps. I wonder, Joe, if we could talk about the gambling that's already legal here in Illinois. And I'm talking about video gambling that's been legal since 2011. What changes are lawmakers talking about now?
There hasn't been anything formally proposed in legislation, but the governor has asked for a progressive graduated tax system on video gaming terminals. Right now, there's a flat 30% that's taken off the top of what's called net terminal income. Governor Pritzker proposed anything above $2.5 million would then be taxed at a 50% rate, which has operators and restaurants and bars, they're a little upset. They think this could cut into their share of how much money comes from video gaming.
So I want to ask about that. I mean, when we're thinking about lobbying in Springfield, Mark, how much lobbying power does the gambling industry have in Springfield, and how are they making their voices heard on this?
I would say a pretty sizable amount. And, you know, this takes shapes in many forms. When you consider what are there, 30,000 video gaming terminals set up in bars and taverns and different establishments across the state. Some of those are big businesses. That's a big focus of their entire enterprise, that they are, you know, a company that installs these machines and makes money on them. But some of these are more mom-and-pop shops that just have one machine or a couple video poker machines in their establishment to help raise a little extra money on the side. And if that tax hits the big and small businesses the same, well, the small businesses just showed up last week here and said, hey, that's going to wipe a big chunk of our revenue out. And so they're asking for different treatment. Governor Pritzker's proposal did call for a progressive tax on the video gaming machines, which I suppose would treat the bigger companies different than the smaller and would give the smaller a little bit of a break. But there's also pretty wide consensus that when the state rolled out the video gaming platforms and legalized that some years ago, that they didn't capture enough revenue from it and that it never really gave the state all the money that they expected at the time. And so there was sort of a disappointment there. Those things have really proliferated, especially here in Springfield. They're all over the place. But the state feels that they missed an opportunity, and so it's almost a foregone conclusion that those taxes on video gaming are going to increase. The question is how much and which companies will take the brunt of it.
That's Mark Maxwell, who's the Capitol Bureau Chief with WCIA 3. We're also speaking with Joe Bustos from the Belleville News Democrat. He's their State House reporter. Joe, I wanted to ask you about the cigarette tax, because Governor Pritzker has proposed a cigarette tax, and we've also seen Senate President Senator John Cullerton also proposing an even bigger increase. With, I think, the tax we were looking at up this morning, right now it's about $2 a pack on the current tax.
Yeah, it's $1.98 per pack, and Governor Pritzker proposed a 32-cent increase in his budget address. Cullerton has thrown his support behind a dollar a pack increase. I think that's going to lead to the same debates that we had during the Tobacco 21 debate, where people might be just going across the river to buy their cigarettes. And that's something important to some of the communities that we cover down here, the Belleville News Democrat. There's right across the river in Missouri. People could go over there and buy cigarettes at a cheaper rate. But the governor has also signaled his support for Cullerton's proposal that he floated last week.
Mark, when we think about that, I wonder, would you say that you think that the cigarette tax, I mean, so far we could group these all into the so-called sin taxes, right? We're thinking about taxing on gambling or cigarettes. When are those pretty usually, I would say, more palatable or more popular tax increases to pass?
Well, I think you're suggesting hitting on the public image of a product, right? And cigarettes certainly are not a popular item, so it's easy for politicians to sort of target them, if you will. I think that may be an easier political thing for them to do, but raising it up to Senate President Cullerton's level would be harder to do. Keep in mind, many of these lawmakers step outside the State House and enjoy a smoke themselves on breaks, and so I don't know how much that factors into their decision, but They do know, especially some of the more conservative anti-tax lawmakers know that if they vote yes to raise taxes on cigarettes, that they may have to answer to some number of their constituents. But again, most everyone agrees that I think it's pretty much decided cigarettes are bad for your health. So some people say this is a way to improve public health by raising the taxes and making it harder for people to afford.
Right. And I mean, certainly there are obviously increased health costs that go along with cancer, like when you think about cancer, lung cancer and cigarettes. So, I mean, I think that in that sense, continuing to raise a tax on cigarettes, you can there could be lots of justifications for raising the tax there. But when we're thinking about how much bipartisan support they have, Mark, would you say that there is bipartisanship in any of these proposals, or what are we seeing?
Well, there are some Republicans interested in another one of these items, which is legalizing recreational cannabis for adult use. There certainly are, as you mentioned, Republican leader Jim Durkin interested in the sports gambling side. Governor Pritzker said he has a laser focus on getting that done. But just by the nature of politics in Springfield, I think you're going to see the majority of Democrats are the ones who are mostly interested in these measures. And if for no other reason than just politics, most of the opposition will come from the Republican side. It still remains to be seen. I mean, some of these things haven't even been really openly debated to pass a committee yet, so it's been hard to put down dividing lines on who might be in and who might be out. But, we're going to get a real clear answer on that here in the next few weeks.
Joe, some of our listeners might recall that a few weeks ago, there's one other tax we haven't talked about, which is a gas tax. And actually, former Transportation Secretary, former Illinois Congressman Ray LaHood testified before the General Assembly to support a gas tax. I wonder, does that have widespread support in the General Assembly?
That might be hard to swallow, because in the southern part of the state, where you got to drive farther to get places, going from 19 cents to, I think, 44 cents per gallon, which Martin Sandoval, State Senator Martin Sandoval, proposed, you're going to be spending more on just a trip to go to the grocery store, a trip to go to work. That is going to be something that's going to be hard to get people's support. If I know that's being discussed as part of a capital bill, and if that does pass, they're going to have some actual projects that say this is going to help Project A, Project B, Project C in my district. Those may be easier to pass up in the Chicago area, where there's a more robust public transportation system.
Right, and it's a tough sell this time of year when everyone's kind of dodging a lot of potholes on the road. I mean, unless you're saying, okay, we're going to actually use it to fill all of these potholes. Mark, before we go, you did mention legalizing recreational cannabis. What are the prospects for that passing now?
Well, that's getting a little bit hairier as we go, and it's not because of the idea of legalizing recreational marijuana, but because of some of the other proposals included in that measure. Right now, the top among them, as Speaker Madigan and a Republican pro-marijuana senator, Jason Berrickman, both outlined this last week, that a deal to forgive or expunge the criminal convictions of some misdemeanors and low-level felonies of former drug dealers included along with those people who just possessed cannabis. That's creating some serious heartburn for lawmakers who may want to legalize cannabis for adult use, but may have a tougher time explaining to the law enforcement in their district why they just undid the convictions of some 800,000 people in the state. And so there's a sense of from some people that are uncomfortable, that they're telling me, hey, look, this was illegal back then. That person still broke the law, and we should think twice before we just open the gate to allow all of those expungements out. And so that process is getting dragged down a little bit. Some labor groups are trying to massage the finer points of the language in the bill. So it still has a fair shot of passing, but it's getting sort of drowned in the legislative process right now, with everybody wanting this bill to do something for them. So it's interesting, but the governor expects $170 million or more to come from the cannabis bill. And because they plan to legalize it starting New Year's Day, not July of next year, that revenue expectation of $170 million can only go up. So they expect to get more money in this next
budget.
Right,
so we'll see how all of this plays out. We've got 2.5 weeks left. I want to thank WCIA3's Mark Maxwell, Belleville News Democrats Joe Bustos. Thanks, guys, for being with me. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Arts Museum at the University of Illinois. Open Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, and Saturday, 10 to 4. Offering a world of art right here in Champaign-Urbana. More at kam.illinois.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Every year, tens of thousands of refugees arrive in the U.S. fleeing war and violence. And adjusting to life here can be hard for many people. Oftentimes, it means not just a new language, getting a new job, being away from family and friends. Refugees can also face legal uncertainty, financial hardship, and social stigma. And on top of that, some may also be dealing with trauma resulting from their time before the U.S. in conflict zones. Unfortunately for many refugees, getting mental health treatment they need can be difficult. Kizito Kalima first came to Indiana after the Rwandan genocide in the 1990s. He's the founder and executive director of the Peace Center for Forgiveness and Reconciliation. That's a nonprofit that helps connect immigrants and refugees with mental health services. Kizito, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me.
Mengxi Zhang is also with us. She's an assistant professor of health science at Ball State University's College of Health. Mengxi, thank you for being with us as well. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla.
And we learned about both of these folks from public radio reporter Laura Bavis in Indianapolis because she reported on this for Side Effects Public Media. Hi, Lauren. Thanks for being with us as well.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Kizito, I wonder if we can start with you, and I wonder if you would mind sharing a little bit of your story. Can you tell us a little bit more about your experience in Rwanda as a teenager before you came to the U.S.?
Yeah, so I was born in Rwanda, of course. 1994 was a genocide against Tutsis, so I was a teenager. I was in high school, and so before the genocide, I grew up in a well-to-do family, so everything was just normal, okay. But after the genocide, things changed, of course. You know, I lost most of my family members, including my parents, and I was left alone. I was left to die in ditch dead bodies. I was lived in the swamps for 3 months, lived in the orphanage, group home, refugee camps, and of course, I suffered a lot in terms of mental health issues. Then when I found out I was diagnosed with PTSD, I don't know what it was when I was suffering from it, because it's not known in our culture. So, but yeah, I was able to find help through different services.
Cazito, that sounds, I'm sorry to hear of everything that you've gone through. How old were you when all of this was happening?
I was 15. I was 15.
Oh, so you're 15. And then how old were you when you were able? So then you lost most of your family and then you were on your own. How, what age were you able to come to the U.S.?
I came to the U.S. after two years and a half. I was 18, turning 19 at that time.
And
so for three years, I was on my own, all over East Africa, actually.
And I mean, I can't imagine that in itself, how hard that must have been as well.
Yeah, it was hard. It was hard because, as I said, I grew up in a well-to-do family. We had, you know, everything I needed. You know, we even have a servant. That's how, you know, my life was. But coming from having everything and losing everything at the same time, it's very traumatic itself. You know, I was very traumatized to the point where, you know, I could not sleep. I could not function. I was angry. I was upset. I had the migraine headaches. I had nightmares. I had, depression. So it was rough. It was rough, and it was tough to deal with it.
So when you got here, I imagine you also went through a period of time where you were probably not just, I imagine, relieved to be here, but it also was a difficult time adjusting. What was that like, your transition coming here to the U.S.?
Oh, that's, it was hard because I couldn't speak English. Okay, I could not speak the language. And, of course, I didn't know what I was suffering from because, you know, our culture, we don't know what is anxiety, depression, nightmares, flashbacks. And it was a tough transition. I remember having headaches, migraine headaches, almost every single day, and not being able to explain to people who I was staying with was hard, and it was hard to deal with it. So, yes, you know, that's the transition was very tough, was very rough, and but I was able to, I was able to survive. That's what I said. You know, I was able to cope with it. But it was rough. It was very tough.
I want to hear a little bit more about that in a minute. But as we're thinking about that, we've been talking with Cazito Kalima. Not just did he survive, but then he founded the Peace Center for Forgiveness and Reconciliation in Indianapolis. Lauren Bavis first reported on this. She's at WFYI in Indianapolis and also with Side Effects Public Media. Lauren, for your reporting, you spoke with Diane Mitschke, professor at the University of Texas at Arlington. I wonder what she told you about the rates of PTSDs among refugees.
Sure. Professor Mitschke's research found that rates of PTSD in refugees could be up to 10 times as high as they are in the general population. She also found that PTSD symptoms, anxiety and depression rates were also much higher in refugees than they are in the general U.S. population.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Mungchi, when we're thinking about coming to the U.S. after, whether you're coming from a war-torn area, how much that is a time of rapid change, as we were hearing Cazito talk about. I wonder, you researched some of the ways people cope with that change, and I wonder if you can talk about ways that you have seen people try to cope with change when they haven't gotten mental health help.
Yeah, so as like Cosetta mentioned, like there's really limited resources, or refugees themselves even don't know they have the problem. So that actually translates to some of the really severe issues. Like some of the refugee community, they realize this issue, and that actually increased the probability for smoking and drinking, and also even like family violence.
I wonder, Lauren, also, it must just be really hard. I mean, I feel like it's hard enough for people who are citizens or residents with resources to think about accessing proper mental health care. What did you learn about barriers to treatment that there are before someone could even get to the whole idea of an appointment, Lauren?
Yeah, I got to speak with some of the folks who do resettling of refugees here in Indianapolis. And the biggest barriers to care by far, they said, were administrative. It's the issues that refugees have even before, like you said, they get to a doctor's office. It's finding out who's a provider, who's someone who's covered by their insurance, what fees are associated with that. As most folks know, you can't just walk into a doctor's office and ask them how much a specific service costs. That's something that then gets dealt with by insurance. And before they get to their appointments, they need everything from taking time off work to getting childcare, getting access to transportation, whether that's, getting a ride or taking a bus or multiple buses. And all of that can take even longer than the actual appointment takes. And then once they get to their appointment, a lot of their intake is, again, going over their trauma. So there's really a need, the folks who I talked to said, in these primary care settings to have what they call trauma-informed care and care that's culturally competent, that takes into consideration, just how much that they've been through and their life experiences.
And when we're thinking about that, Mengqi, I can't help but think what Casito said just about not even really, even just not even having a language or understanding even what PTSD would be. I wonder what kind of cultural barriers you're seeing also within the healthcare system, specifically when it comes to navigating mental health treatment and different cultural barriers.
Right. So when we talk about these individual barriers, like when we just talk about the refugees, so as mentioned, they really have a limited knowledge and information about the mental health and even mental health services. And also talking about the cultural barriers. So in some of the culture, like they even do not have a language for some of the mental illness, like or problems, like stigma or anxiety. There's just not a word to even use to express themselves. So when we think about the language barrier, it really increased the barrier for them to see doctors, like physical doctors, but that actually adding another layer of difficulties to express themselves clearly regarding the psychological issues.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder also too, Mengqi, to Casito's point, like he was having headaches and that was a physical manifestation. And I wonder how often maybe that happens. People, perhaps if they do even have a primary care doctor going to talk about complaining about physical symptoms that maybe could be manifestations of mental health problems.
Exactly. That's a really good point. So the recent study also find that so refugees are always confused about their physical and psychological symptoms because sometimes psychological symptoms actually will increase the probability for some physical symptoms. So like if like without this, like there's no, this is knowledge, this could like also increase the barriers for them to cannot express themselves clear for these symptoms and problems.
Mm-hmm. Casito, I wonder if you could weigh in here about how did you, I wonder if you can share with us a little bit of your process of how you got help.
Oh, so I got help, when the physical pain became unbearable, when I passed out and almost thought I was having a heart attack, and I could not believe what it was because I was young, I was I was playing sports, very, very fit physically, but when I was driving actually from school and work one time, I was in college, and I blacked out completely, so I started shaking, and I was sweating, and I didn't know what was going on. So I was able to park and take a break a little bit, and then went back to my apartment. And the next day, I went to the doctor. The school doctor, the school nurse, and she knew me. She knew that I used to come there to get a lot of pain medicine, like I had a lot of headache medicines. And she asked me exactly what was going on because she could not, she didn't find it. I was telling her that I was having a heart attack because I didn't know exactly what it was. But she told me it was a panic attack. And it was, and when I told her my background, and now she kind of connected that, she realized that all my headaches, all my migraine headaches that I always have every single day, it's because of what I went through. Because I was a hit, I was hacked with a machete in my head. I have a dent. They cracked my skull when I was a teenager during the genocide, and that injury, the scar, and I guess contributed to a lot of headaches. But I didn't know what it was, and it was that time when I realized that I needed help. I have gone through therapy, but it was not working because even the therapy, they will tell me what to do, but they never pointed out exactly the source or the cause of, the cause of with the migraines, the migraine headache I was having, the physical pain I was having. So, and that's when I started sharing my story. That's when I started talking about it.
I wonder, as you started sharing your story, and obviously these are really horrific things that, as you're sharing your personal experience, what you lived through, also then seeing what happened to your family, did you find when you first started sharing your story that you had providers who were able to help you effectively?
Oh, honestly, not really, because it's hard. The thing is, this is my biggest concern or my biggest obstacles even if I seek help, because when you go to a doctor or to a provider, my story or this story, personally, my story, it's unique. It's unique because, you know, there are few. I don't think that the people are prepared for the genocide survivors. You know, unless you somebody who's maybe come from the Holocaust survivors, maybe that's the people I find very understanding. You know, like somebody who's a grandfather or grandmother has been through the Holocaust, they understand a little bit about PTSD. So, sharing my story has helped personally, but finding a provider, it's hard because, as many mentioned, there's a cultural differences, there's a lack of understanding, and the lack of explaining, because we don't have a word in our language of anxiety. We don't have a word of depression. So, translating PTSD to an immigrant, especially like me, was hard for me to even tell people what I'm suffering from, you know, because I will combine everything. I'll say I have a headache, I have a nightmares, and it was just those type of things. So I didn't find like a provider that would help me to the point where I felt better. So I felt better when I start talking, when I start sharing, and I start owning it, because I was ashamed of sharing my story, and I was ashamed of, I was scared of reception. But once I got over that, I was like, okay, I need to share my story as much as I can. That for last almost 12, close to 15 years, I've been talking and sharing a story, go around the world and share, and it helps a lot.
Mungshi, I imagine. Especially, I wonder how much you think there's still a stigma around seeking help. And I'm thinking particularly also of thinking about people who are coming from other countries, especially in this political climate where there's so much conversation around refugees and immigrants wanting to keep as low a profile as possible, too.
Exactly. And I think for some like illegal immigrants, the situation is getting worse. A recent study was looking for like the relevantly conservative states and non-conservative states, comparing their healthcare service utilization situation. And for the state which is more conservative, the situation for refugees is extremely bad. And now to think about the mental health issues. And when we think about the mental health issues, and I think as the as Kazedo also mentioned, I want to point out like a cultural stigma. So in majority of Asian countries, people from there always feel like talking about the mental health issues is really losing your family's face. So if like, for example, a family member have some mental health issues and seeking for health care, so that really like make the whole family feel horrible about the situation. So that actually also increase the barriers for them to seeking for health care. And also a language barrier. So I was thinking about if the health agencies could provide translators for them that actually could solve the situation. But after I talked with the refugees, the situation was completely different. So they were complaining about the translation quality is actually not that good. And even the people could translate some of the meaning of their feelings, but the culture-based understanding is still not there. So they're different. Like barriers in different levels.
Right. Well, we have to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation and we're going to hear a little bit from Kazedo about how he wants treatment to be different and what it's like for the refugees he's helping with his Peace Center for Forgiveness and Reconciliation in Indianapolis. We'll tweet out Lauren's story on this as well. Lauren Bavis is the one who brought us this story for Side Effects Public Media. So if you're interested in reading more, check out our Twitter handle and we'll put it up on our Facebook, on our website as well. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll be right back. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about the difficulties many refugees face when they're trying to get mental health care, and we've been speaking with Kizito Kalima. He's based in Indiana. He's the founder of a nonprofit that connects immigrants and refugees to mental health resources. Kizito, I wonder how your experience, as not just your life experience during the Rwanda genocide, but your experience coming to the U.S. and being in Indianapolis and getting mental health help, how do you want things to be different now for people who are coming to you for help?
So coming to me, I'm not a licensed, counselor. I use my personal experience and I refer to people. That's what I want to let people know that, but once you come to me and once you come to office, I understand exactly the culture. I understand the suffering and the cultural translation. As other people said, the cultural translation, that's the biggest obstacle for every hospital, every counseling centers, because people don't know how to translate, the suffering of the refugees to American culture. And sometimes people who go there, especially the refugees, of course, they have barriers, a language barrier, so they don't know how to express themselves. So what we do and what I would like to do for other hospitals or other providers is to make sure that they have the person who understands the culture. Understanding the language is not enough. Understanding the culture. The culture means, if somebody said that my family calls me crazy, which is the term of everybody who's suffering from anxiety. Our culture is crazy. Crazy can be different. It can be bipolar, other kind of mental health issues. And that stigma prevents people to go to the hospital. And even if they go there, they're not able to express themselves. They said, my family thinks I'm crazy, or I think I'm crazy. So therefore, they're not able to define exactly what they're suffering from. So what I would like to see in provided the mental health services here in Indianapolis or all over USA, it's having people who understand the culture or partner, or they can partner with the centers. Like our center can help the translation. I know other churches which based with immigrants, which helps immigrants and other, organization. But make sure that you have their third party, that person who understands the culture, who can translate the culture more than the language.
Right. So you work with, Kizito, you work with, it sounds like, not just healthcare providers, but churches and other groups that are helping resettle refugees as well, right?
Definitely. My background is criminal justice, public safety, law enforcement, social services. So I do work with all the services that I can help the refugees. My goal is to make sure at least the refugees has a decent life. It's based on my personal, I'll call it my passion, because I hate to see people suffering, because I suffered a lot at a younger age. And I feel like the best thing I can do is to help others not to go through what I went through. It took me almost 15 years to get to the point where I am right now. So when I see young people who come and they have opportunities and have potential to become better, within 2-3 years, it makes me want to do more. And that's why I'm the voice of the refugees. I'm the voice of people who have mental health issues, because I know how it is and I know how it can be a hindrance. So something can to people, getting better services or getting better life.
Well, thank you for sharing your story with us, and thank you for sharing your work. That's Kizito Kalima, is the founder of the Peace Center for Forgiveness and Reconciliation in Indianapolis. I want to thank Mengxi Zhang for being with us as well, an assistant professor of health science at Ball State University, who studies displaced populations, and Lauren Bavis, who brought us a story from Side Effects Public Media. All of you, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Dressing for success in the political arena has long meant striking the right balance between professional and casual, powerful and relatable. And while that's still the case, nowadays there's a lot more to navigating political attire than choosing between business casual or black tie. For that reason, politicians like our governor, J.B. Pritzker, turn to his staff for daily advice on what to wear, but he's not the only one. That's according to New York Times fashion director and chief fashion critic Vanessa Friedman. She's been writing about this for the Times. She's on the line with us now from New York for more. Hi, Vanessa. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Nice to talk to you.
So, Vanessa, in your piece, you wrote about our governor, J.B. Pritzker. Actually, John O'Connor from the AP actually used FOIA records to get access to the governor's daily schedule. Can you tell us a little bit about what he found out and what kind of caught your eye about the governor's fashion recommendations?
Well, I think he discovered almost daily notations from the governor's staff on his schedule, saying, you know, business casual, suit, bring different ties. Maybe this is, you know, this is an occasion for a Patagonia or the Columbia jacket. So they're getting more specific, more detailed, and also more varied than I think we would be used to seeing in this situation.
Right. And I mean, obviously, when we think about politics, politicians being in the spotlight, when we think about, especially in this era of social media, it makes sense their clothes are a topic of conversation. I wonder, though, do you think it's changing when we're thinking about men and the way men are approaching this? Men are maybe, I think it used to just be, you know, a governor wears a suit, and that's really not the case anymore.
Well, I think men have always been, and politicians in general, have always been hyper aware of their image making and what they wear, but the time spent in the public eye was more limited in the past because we were not in an age of social media where literally every single time you stepped outside of your door, someone could take a picture. And that picture could go around the world and judgments could be made about you based on that picture. So, you know, you would do a public event or you would have a photo op and you would know it was coming and you could plan for it. But now, essentially, as soon as you get up in the morning until you go to sleep, every moment is a possible photo op, and you have to be highly attuned to that and to what kind of potential messaging you could be sending, whether it's spoken or most of the time actually unspoken.
And so it was so interesting to me, Vanessa, reading the comments on your story, because it was a lot of people from Illinois, and they took it as an opportunity to talk about every other governor and our previous governor and his penchant for wearing motorcycle jackets. There were comments about that. And then there were also comments about J.B. Pritzker. And I imagine, of course, as someone who is the wealthiest politician in America, there were also comments about, well, it's really important what he wears because people are already making judgments about him.
This is always true. You know, I think there's a real balancing act that politicians have to walk, whether they're governors or mayors or presidents or presidential candidates, between looking accessible, as you said earlier, and looking kind of like your leadership material. And often leadership material, for many people, it tends to connote, you know, more formality in dress that looks better tailored, you know, perhaps more expensive. And especially when you bring with you into office all sorts of stereotypes and, you know, suppositions about your own kind of economic background or pedigree, you know, this becomes even more fraught. So I wasn't surprised that people would comment on that. And, you know, I think it is, I'm sure it is something that his advisors have talked through with him.
And so obviously this isn't just Governor Pritzker. You also wrote about 2020 Democratic presidential candidates like Beto O'Rourke, how he's using fashion to his advantage. I'm thinking about, I believe, what's a Vanity Fair cover that he was just on, correct me if I'm wrong?
Yeah, the Vanity Fair December cover when he all but announced his candidacy and was, you know, out there on the open road with his truck and his shirt sleeves and his jeans looking, you know, like some sort of pioneer man, you know, ready to kind of pave a new path. It was an image that tapped into all sorts of American myths, you know, literally just through the picture without any quotations or any text. And it's that kind of communication that I think politicians are getting ever more adept at, and also that's becoming more important. And you really do see it already with this like incredibly broad slate of candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination, all of whom are sort of distinguishing themselves via image.
So where have we come when we're thinking about When I'm thinking about fashion controversies, we were enjoying reading about former President Obama's tan suit, when he wore a tan suit, and that was one of the most controversial parts of his presidency. People were so upset that he showed up in a tan suit. And I wonder now, have we just sort of taken for, are we maybe at a different point now of scrutinizing male fashion choices?
I think this started long before Obama, honestly. Reagan was a great, really, if you go all the way back to Kennedy and Nixon, to the dawn of the TV age, and that debate, when it first became clear that people were going to make judgments about a politician's fitness and character and relatability based on how they looked. And as I said, it's only gotten more true as we've gotten more and more, as the sort of image communication has gotten speeded up. And, certainly Obama was hyper aware of this and quite effective at using it, that tan suit moment aside. He was someone who was endlessly photographed with his shirt sleeves rolled up.
Or his dad jeans.
Or, looking out, or the dad jeans, but the shirt sleeves first, looking out over the window, kind of serious at work, ready to get down to the business of governing. He was also someone who was often photographed without a tie and, was very much using that moment to kind of communicate generational change and maybe a more relaxed White House, which was very much part of his platform. And, and he talked about it. He did a Vanity Fair interview where he said to Michael Lewis, "I wear almost always navy suits or dark gray suits, and it is because I have made a conscious decision to take that element of choice out of my day. I have to make so many decisions."
I remember reading that. That was just right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was really striking because he was completely relaxed about the idea that someone might ask him about his clothing choices, and he was completely relaxed about talking about his clothing choices and the fact he had thought about them and made a decision. Whereas at that stage, most women in the public eye, and granted there weren't very many of them, there was Mrs. Clinton, were very defensive and angry and didn't want to talk about clothing because they felt it somehow was demeaning to them or, was an attempt to kind of take away their credibility or their substance.
Well, and that's very interesting because when John O'Connor from the AP asked Governor Pritzker to comment on this, he did not get a response. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you think this is something that especially male politicians aren't willing to talk about.
I think they have been more willing to talk about it, actually, than women politicians have. And I think, honestly, the more everybody talks about it, the better for all of us, because the more we acknowledge this as a factor, not obviously the most important factor, clearly, policy positions and legislating is significantly more important than clothing choices, but it is part of the politician's communication arsenal. And the more that we acknowledge that, the less it can be weaponized against anybody or used to, attack them, demean them somehow, make them seem less serious. So, I think it would have been all to his benefit if he could have risen above and said, yes, I have, like Obama did, all these, important decisions to make. I have serious state issues to consider. So why not offload what I have to wear every day to my staff?
Last question for you, Vanessa. We're speaking with Vanessa Friedman, fashion director for The New York Times. What's your response to people who say, why are we even talking about this? Why does this matter?
Because it is a way that our candidates and anyone in the public eye attempts to manipulate our reaction to them and our perceptions of them. And the more we're aware of how our own judgments are being skewed, the more equipped we are to make better judgments.
That's Vanessa Friedman, fashion director with The New York Times. We'll tweet out her piece, that piece, as well as John O'Connor's piece about Governor J.B. Pritzker. Thank you for taking the time to be with us, Vanessa. I appreciate it.
Pleasure to speak to you.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, how much do you know about 5G? Well, depending on where you live, you can download data up to 20 times faster than you do now. We're going to talk about how that works, what it could mean for your day-to-day life. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. You can also search for us on Facebook. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us at social media, just remember our website. That's 21stShow.org. We've got all of our past shows there as well. And you can also find us most places you get your podcasts. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Apalson is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.